Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news as Iraq falls apart and Lebanon appears to be on the brink of falling apart. We'll first talk about Iraq with Mark Danner, who's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books. He's a professor at UC Berkeley and at Bard College, and he writes about foreign affairs and American politics. He's the author of Torture and Truth, and his most recent book is The Secret Way to War. He has a major new feature article in the New York Review of Books, which is also being carried on Salon.com, entitled Iraq, War of Imagination. We'll also talk about Lebanon on the cusp of a reignited civil war. We'll go to Beirut and speak with Habib Battah, who is a print and broadcast journalist, who's worked for Al Jazeera, the Daily News newspaper in Beirut, and the Beirut-based satellite channel Future Television. And he's covered a range of political events across the Middle East, including the Iraq war and the recent war in Lebanon. And then we'll talk about the apparent political assassination of a former KGB officer in London. And we'll talk both about the poisoning itself with the country's leading expert on exotic assassinations and poisons. Milton Leitenberg is a senior research scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. He's a biochemist specializing in neurochemistry, and he's been working in the field of international arms control since 1966. He's an acknowledged expert on the use of poison for political assassination. And also from London, we'll speak with Philip Knightley, who's the leading journalist in Great Britain, who's covered intelligence for some time. He's an award-winning journalist and author of a number of books specializing on intelligence matters, such as The First Casualty, The Second Oldest Profession, and Philby, the KGB Master Spy. He was the only Western reporter to have met with Philby. I'm speaking with Mark Danner, who's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. He's a frequent contributor to The New York Review of Books and a professor at UC Berkeley and Bard College. He has written a book, Torture and Truth. His most recent book is The Secret Way to War, and he has a major new feature article in The New York Review of Books, which is also being carried on Salon.com and Tom Dispatch, entitled Iraq, War of Imagination. At this point, Mark Danner, I'm not sure whether our faith-based president has entered the real world, but he's certainly heading to Jordan on Wednesday, and I believe the vice president is supposed to be in Saudi Arabia and possibly Iraq. So if this is a war of imagination, of their imagination, at what point is the denial over? And when does reality get some traction here?
Well, that's a good question, Ian. I think that one of the great functions of the elections a couple weeks ago were that they were a kind of hand reaching into the White House and grasping the president's shirt collar and giving him a shake. I think on the day after the elections, during his press conference, when he said, "I thought we were going to be okay," meaning he thought the Republicans would hold the House and the Senate, I think that seemed to me very much a sincere statement, that the election results were a bit of a shock to him. And I think that probably, and maybe this is a hopeful analysis, was the beginning of his return to reality, particularly about how Americans feel about the Iraq war. And the fact that their willingness to continue to support it is at an end. Having said that, I'm not sure what the consequences will actually be, because, of course, the implication is that if the leadership would simply realize that Americans want out of the war, they would do something and we would have a consequence. The problem now is, it seems to me, that it's going to become very quickly clear to them, if it hasn't been for a while, and also to Americans, that actually leaving, getting quit of the war, is going to mean, in one way or another, admitting that this war is a failure and perhaps a catastrophe. And, you know, saying one would like to get the Americans out is very far from saying one is willing to admit that this has been a failure and to take all the consequences that come with that. There's an assumption that perhaps now there can be a solution. You know, now that the political system has expressed itself and Americans have shown that they're done with the war, they want it to end, that what will follow will be some kind of manageable solution to the war. And yet, Americans' exhaustion with the war is wholly independent from the situation on the ground, which is getting much worse.
Well, it may be, and I think it has been for some time. The reality has been that we don't have any options. We, the government and the press and the public, continue with the delusion that there's an Iraqi government, when if you ever talk to an Iraqi, the government doesn't extend beyond the street corner, and the government is whichever tribe, faction, group of thugs control your street. We continually talk about, in fact, the Democrats have fallen into this trap where Bush's mistake has become their problem. And the reality seems to have been all along that we don't have any options. And it seems that it's falling apart so quickly that perhaps by the time Baker gets his study together, it'll be moot.
Well, I think it's quite true that when we talk about the war in our polity, whether it's the Democrats, the administration, or even people who write about the war, they rely on a set of assumptions that are inaccurate and are rapidly being shown to be inaccurate on the ground. One of them is this notion that you have a government and then you have a war, and the thing to do is to help the government get control of the ground and control of the instruments of violence so the government can put an end to the war. But in fact, of course, the government is bound up very directly in the war. I would disagree with you slightly in the assumption that the government doesn't exist or it's irrelevant. In fact, increasingly the problem is that the militias and the various groups fighting have their reflection in the government itself. So the notion that, you know, the government has to, you know, Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister, has to get tough and show the will to dismantle the militias, which is the heart of the rhetoric coming from the administration and has been for some time, is almost nonsensical because the prime minister is wholly dependent on at least one of those militias, the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr, for his political support. So the idea that he can, you know, he has to get tough and it's only a matter of his will to eliminate this militia is a ridiculous point. It makes no sense, and people in Iraq know this. So we're relying on various rhetorical and conceptual assumptions that simply have no bearing on the ground. I think it's becoming clear to the administration and probably to the various study groups working, including the Baker Commission, that there is not going to be a list of a half dozen proposals that will quickly put an end to the violence and make it possible for the United States to have a decent interval in some way, that is to get out at a point where it seems the violence is decreasing and things are going better. So the American polity is going to have to start to face the fact that to actually get out soon will mean admitting that the war will continue and possibly get worse. Because, you know, if you look at it now, you see a worsening situation, the chaos is rising, the violence is rising very quickly. But it's quite possible to see in the near future, imagine in the near future, a catastrophic situation in which you have the Iraq civil war, as it now is, becoming a regionalized civil war involving neighboring states. And that, however horrible the situation is at present within the country of Iraq, would be much, much worse. So the question is, can the United States depart in some way while forestalling somehow that graver outcome? And I'm not sure that it can.
Well, presumably when the civil war finally, they take the gloves off, and obviously a part of the reason that that the Shia haven't gone full bore is that we've been obliging them by killing their enemy, the Sunni. But at a certain point, it seems that the lust for revenge is such that the gloves will come off, and whoever is driven into, you know, they're trying to drive, ethnically cleanse the Sunni and drive them into Al-Anbar, presumably the Sunni's patrons, the Saudis, the Egyptians, and the Jordanians, won't see them driven into the sea, and conversely, although it's likely, the Iranian patrons of the Shia won't see them defeated either. Not that that's particularly likely, but
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, you've set out very well the interests of the neighboring states. And, you know, we are seeing in a strange way a replay with the players wearing different clothes of the war between the Iraqis and the Iranians of the 1980s, in which, of course, the United States supported Saddam with the help also of the Egyptians, the Saudis, and others. And it's as if that war has moved west a couple of hundred miles. So whereas before it was at the Iraq-Iran border, now it runs through Baghdad. And it's a Shia-Sunni conflict. But in the former war, as I say, we supported the Sunnis and supported Saddam. In this war, it's unclear what the U.S. role exactly is, because the United States, of course, is supporting a Shia, a government that's predominantly Shia. At the same time, it's fighting Sunnis on the ground, but also trying to push the Shia leadership to make a deal with the Sunnis. Its politics is very complicated, and so far not very effective. And as you say, you know, one possible future is that neighboring states and the sides they're on are already very clear, will become much more significantly involved. I think one of the outcomes, or one of the recommendations from the vaunted Baker Iraq Study Group, will likely be a vigorous involvement with neighboring states. But, you know, and this is the shorthand for this, and the press has come to be, talk to Syria, talk to Iran, as if the United States hasn't been talking to those states. It has been. The problem, of course, isn't talking to them. The problem is whether the United States is willing to do the things it'll take to do in order to get an agreement with those states. And so far, it has not been willing to do that. Certainly, one part of it would be giving up on pushing and pressuring Iran on its nuclear program. And the United States has not shown itself willing to make that kind of a compromise. And I don't know that it can.
But Mark Danner, it seems though, when I suggested that the Iraqi government is something of a fiction, and it's true that Maliki's tied in with the Al-Mahdi army, and it's also, you know, apparently somebody close to Muqtada Sadr basically gave him an ultimatum: if you talk to Bush, we pull out of the government, and the government collapses. But the long and the short of it is, would this government even be an entity but for the fact that it's in the green zone, it's in the Emerald City, it's protected by the U.S. military, they walk around with phalanxes of bodyguards? It seems to me that in the real world, without bodyguards, they wouldn't be a government. And, you know, the military, the only units that apparently are reliable are the Peshmerga units, the Kurdish units. The rest of them are infiltrated and have become factionalized. And, of course, the police themselves are an extension of factional death squads. So,
well,
I mean, I think that we do. One of the canards that the administration has hoisted for some time is that the reporters don't tell the good news. I think you could make a stronger argument that we don't tell the bad news.
Well, I agree with that. I think that things in Iraq are grimmer than they appear, and it's been that way for quite some time. I wholly agree with that. And I think your summary of the Iraqi government is, you know, I agree with most of the details. I guess I would just, I wouldn't agree with you in saying that it doesn't really exist. I mean, it does exist. It certainly doesn't have a lot of power. But on the other hand, it is this loose agglomeration of political forces, some of which are running militias, including the Mahdi Army and the Badr Organization, which are the two largest militias in Iraq, and they belong to the two most powerful parties within the Iraqi government. So, you know, this is not a government in the sense that most Americans would recognize. On the other hand, it does exist. It is this group of politicians. It has been elected with a lot of votes. So I don't, you know, can it hold sway over the entire country? Absolutely not. Does it have power in certain parts of the country, in certain parts of the capital? Yes, it does, mostly through the militias and to some degree through the army, which, as you say, is infiltrated. The police even more are infiltrated. And in fact, you know, not long ago, the if you were watching Iraqi national television, there was a crawl across the bottom of the screen that essentially said, you know, if Iraqi police or military come to your door, do not admit them. Do not open the door unless they are accompanied by American troops. So the normal way that the death squads operate is they're wearing police or Iraqi police or Iraqi military uniforms. Now, are they actually part of the police or military? Probably sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. But in fact, the situation is deeply murky in a way that I agree with you. Americans wouldn't call this a normal government. There's no question about it. On the other hand, it is something. Mm-hmm. It does have some kind of power. Its power is limited and strange, but it does exist, I think.
And it's also true that that the country itself has lost its professional class and its educated people. And anybody that's got can scrape anything together is getting out. So it doesn't bode well for any kind of center or any moderating force. It seems to me everybody's just hunkered down, terrified to open the door. And there's that one little Sunni enclave right in the next to Sadr City where the people were doused with gasoline and burned alive. Mm-hmm. So as they came out of a mosque. So it seems to me that that one way or another, what we're witnessing is ethnic cleansing.
Yes, I think that's true. Although, you know, that term, of course, we had in Bosnia, where I covered, and it was no more accurate then than it is in Iraq. That the differences are not ethnic; the differences are religious.
Religious,
as they were in Bosnia. But unfortunately, we seem to be fated to use that term. I mean, you're quite right that enormous numbers of people are leaving. The UN estimate, which is probably low, is 2 million, which is 8% of the population of Iraq. And that number seems to be growing very, very rapidly. It's, of course, tends to be the middle class and upper middle class, particularly the professional class, which has been targeted for assassination. Doctors, lawyers, and others have been killed at a quite rapid rate, and they're getting out. And the country, you know, you may soon have a situation not unlike Afghanistan, where you had a very large percentage of the population in exile in neighboring states, which, of course, might be another reason that neighboring states could be induced to try to put together some kind of agreement. But that is probably grasping at straws. I mean, there's no question that the situation is devolving and deteriorating quite rapidly. And it's also worth saying, I mean, I think you said something very true, certainly something I agree with, when you said that the impression we get here is probably better and more positive than is justified, even though the administration for years has been saying the press is giving too grim an impression. I agree with you about that, and that's partly a result of the fact that if you're a journalist in Iraq now, a lot of your coverage is centered in the green zone. You know, you go there, you report on press conferences, you talk to the government, and it is true that this gives the government much more credit for controlling things than it probably should have. The mechanics of actually reporting in Iraq are now so difficult, it's so dangerous, the mobility is so restricted, that reporters cover what they can cover. And part of that, of course, is working within the green zone and covering the government. And that tends to put too much emphasis on the government. I think that's quite true. I'm not sure quite how to fix it or what to do about it, but I think that is the case.
And, of course, President Bush on Wednesday will be in neighboring Jordan, which is the largest recipient of these refugees. The entire Iraqi professional class seems to be camped out there.
Yeah.
That's got to be putting a lot of pressure on the Jordanian government. The Syrians are also hosting a lot of refugees as well.
Well, if any of your listeners had been wise enough to buy real estate in Damascus or Amman about 5 years ago, they would have done very well. Because the real estate prices in both of those places have gone way up, and a lot of that is money and investment coming out of Iraq. It's true the president will be talking to the prime minister. And it's anyone's guess what will come out of that. Presumably, They will try to get another agreement of some sort on moving against the militias. But there's an obvious problem here. I mentioned before that the militias, that al-Maliki depends on the largest militia for political support. And there's also the obvious problem that you can't, the militias, insofar as they protect their particular ethnic groups, cannot be dismantled as a matter of fact until those groups, until you have another source of security. Mm-hmm. In other words, until whether the United States or the Iraqi army, the nascent Iraqi army, until they can somehow secure the capital and secure other cities, there will be no way to dismantle these militias. And that is a contradiction that, for example, the operation over the summer, Operation Together Forward, which was supposed to secure Baghdad, was supposed to address. And this operation was a failure. In fact, very unusually, the commander in Baghdad admitted it was a failure. Attacks went up 26% during the operation. So until you can actually supply security and protect people, the militias are not going to be dismantled. And the United States,
and the very militia that Saada runs, that al-Maliki's tied in with, the ones that kidnapped the American soldier recently, the U.S. threw up a cordon around Saada City with roadblocks, and then eventually Maliki, with pressure from Saada, from Muqtada Saada, had these roadblocks removed, and the American soldier still remains in their custody if he's alive. Yeah. So that, that shows you what a fraud it is that remember, this was the guy that Bremer said we were going to take out, and now McCain is saying we should take him out. You know, so all this macho rhetoric that seems to be baying into the wind. You know,
yes, but you put your finger on this a moment ago that the government itself, in the eyes of most Iraqis, is thought of not as a legitimate government, and to some degree as a tool of the Americans, and of course. So there's a natural dynamic, among other things, for Maliki to try to declare himself independent and not be seen acting at the behest of the Americans. And you've seen this dynamic frequently, particularly in the last month, in which the Americans, as you say, tried to cordon off Saada City, and he demanded that these cordons be removed. They also staged a few raids within Saada City, and he rose up and said, the prime minister, that is, that he hadn't approved this, and he denounced them. So you're getting this nationalist backlash from the top of the government that is not going to go away. In fact, it'll probably become stronger, I would think. It'll be interesting to see what kind of statement the two leaders issue after their meeting, and to see whether they can agree on the same words.
Well, I'm not holding my breath that anything that they'll say will have much to do with reality. And certainly, it does seem that there are no good options. I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Mark Danner.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Mark Danner, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, and he has a piece in the current issue of the New York Review of Books entitled Iraq, War of Imagination. That's also available at salon.com. I'm now speaking with Habib Batar, who's a print and broadcast journalist who's worked for some of the Arab world's leading publications and broadcast organizations, including Al Jazeera, Lebanon's Daily Star newspaper, and the Beirut-based satellite channel Future Television. And we spoke a little while back during the Israeli war with Hezbollah. And now it appears, Habib, that the country's on the poised to, for a while, Lebanon was a state, then it became a failed state, 15-year civil war, and now it's back together again, and now it appears to be starting to fray. It's obvious that the Hezbollah are making a push for power. I mean, isn't it pretty clear that a bunch of their ministers resigned from the government. One minister in the government was assassinated. And if one more minister goes, then the government falls, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's true. Lebanon is at one of its tensest moments in recent history. Just after the assassination of the minister, Pierre Jamil, a few days ago, there was a mass exodus of traffic from Beirut. And I just remember looking at this traffic jam of people just heading home, heading for the hills, basically, in fear of of what they believe could be another civil war, because actually the last figure that was assassinated was a very influential family who has been in Lebanese politics for many years, and assassinating someone from that family was really something that you could see as a flashpoint sparking a civil war in Lebanon. So I was pretty surprised myself at the panic among the people, but I mean, then again, I have to emphasize that over the last 2 days, people have been out again, and people have been going out to nightclubs, and it seems to try to resume some semblance of a normal life in Lebanon. That's the way it's been in Lebanon lately, is kind of a really up and down swing between periods of instability and relative calm.
And is there any? There's also all kinds of speculation as to who was behind the assassination of the minister from the Jamal family, the Falangist party. The leader of the Druze, Walid Jumblatt, blames it squarely on Syria, as does the son of the assassinated former President Hariri. His son Assad also lays it at Syria's feet. So I guess there are also other possibilities, aren't there?
Sure, everyone has their own interpretation. I mean, a lot of Lebanese high-level officials are very open and very vocal about blaming Syria for this event. Then again, there really isn't any hard evidence. Everybody is basing their claims on circumstantial evidence, who the situation benefits most. And then again, everybody has their own competing claims. People could say that the government, the current government, benefits because they're given more attention and they've taken the spotlight away from Hezbollah's attempt to dethrone the government. On the other hand, the situation weakens the government because it is this pro-Western government that has resided over all of the assassinations in Lebanon with no, with absolutely no investigation or suspects, any really hardcore leads on this situation. So one can look at the situation in many ways and give blame or advantage to different actors in Lebanon, and there are plenty to spread the blame.
But the UN inquiry into who assassinated Hariri, the government, albeit in a very weak state, did forward that tribunal to the UN. So that's presumably going to go ahead. The point you're making, though, is that with all these political assassinations, there's not been one trial, arrest, or anything.
Sure. I mean, we haven't even had a sketch, really, on the on TV, for example, of a suspect or any real evidence, a car, license plate. I mean, it's really surprising that you have so many events, so many high-level crimes taking place in the country, and really no good police work whatsoever. So that doesn't really bode well for the current government either.
Now, what about the Melis, the UN commission that led by the German policeman investigator? Didn't they pin it on, or at least they said there were some people in Syrian intelligence they wanted to talk to, plus a number of their Lebanese counterparts?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there has been a general consensus, I think, among the UN. There have been many reports, actually, since the assassination, and two different investigators. But basically, the common thread has been blaming Syria, if not directly, indirectly, for being responsible for security in Lebanon at the time of the assassination. And also, there have been a number of Syrian officials that have been wanted to be questioned, and generally, the assumption that the Lebanese security forces were under Syrian control at the time of the assassination.
But there's also, I think, a feeling expressed by a lot of people, somewhat cynically, but nevertheless, that this role that Syria is playing, particularly in the last war with Hezbollah and Israel, is that they're happy to fight Israel to the last Lebanese.
And that's a view that's shared by a lot of Lebanese. And the feeling is that basically Lebanon is basically a trump card for Syria. Lebanon is Syria's way to be in the international diplomacy game. It's a way for to be involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Hezbollah has proved in this recent war to be a very valuable card in that sense, because it is able to resist and defy one of the most powerful militaries in the world. And Syria has not been able to make any similar resistance movement in Syria to reclaim the Golan Heights, which is a much bigger piece of land than actually the land in dispute in Lebanon, and much more strategic, probably. So many here do believe that Syria definitely manipulates the situation in Lebanon to their advantage on the international politics level.
And what they encourage in Lebanon, they wouldn't tolerate at home. They would never tolerate a religious party like Hezbollah.
Yes, Syria is a secular state. There are no religious political parties as such that are really involved in the government. And it is interesting to note that that's a difference in Lebanon. The Lebanese political system is just full of religious connotations and religious affiliations, while the Syrian system is very secular in nature.
But it seems to be, though, that once religion enters any political situation, that as long as you're dealing in the secular realm, you seem to have a chance of resolving problems. But the minute religion enters the formula, I think many options are foreclosed, because religion by definition is often deals with absolutes and is therefore inflexible. And when you have a party that's title is Hezbollah, the party of God, its leader, Hassan Nasrallah's name means victory through God. So how much is this the Hezbollah how do they coexist with the secular Christians? And that's got to chafe with them, apparently.
Well, actually, a large number of Christians in Lebanon support Hezbollah. They support Hezbollah basically through a political party headed by a former Lebanese general who was exiled from Lebanon and now is back in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. That's General Aoun, right?
Michel Aoun, yes. No. So it's really unclear. In some sense, the battles that are being waged right now are not really religious ones. They're political battles. They're battles over Lebanon's identity, where Lebanon will lean toward. Will Lebanon be a Western-leaning country or an Eastern-leaning country? Will Lebanon fall into the negotiating block of Iran and Syria with the United States, or will Lebanon be on the opposite end of the spectrum? And this is a problem with identity that Lebanon's had for basically its entire existence, ever since it was created. And some people might argue that, like in Iraq, Lebanon was a false creation because it brought together very disparate communities. So it's not really always a religious battle in Lebanon. I mean, in fact, some of the bloodiest wars in Lebanon were fought by Christians fighting each other. Mm-hmm. And that was actually two of those leaders were Michel Aoun and Samir Jaja, who have Samir Jaja being jailed and being released from jail recently, and Michel Aoun also being exiled and returned from Lebanon recently. So in a way, what's interesting is what you have in Lebanon today is kind of an unraveling of the developments that led to the end of the civil war in the early 90s, and that was the imprisonment or exile of certain leaders and the Syrian occupation of Lebanon. Now the Syrian occupation is removed, the leaders are back. It's really a question of politics between people, not always religion. I don't think that Hezbollah is trying to or is even able to dominate Lebanese society or change Lebanese social habits. If you know, Lebanon is a very freewheeling society. I mean, basically, women would wear bikinis in Lebanon. Women would wear also the full covering, the chador. And you have really that vibrant mix in Lebanon of two competing extremes. So I don't think that you could really change that in Lebanon. What Hezbollah is really trying to do, I think, is to continue its political position and not to be weakened in any way. And actually, the developments today, I mean, I would think that in the long term, discussions of disarming Hezbollah inevitably would lead to less power for them.
Well, everybody's waiting for their big demonstration, aren't they? They're supposed to take to the streets anytime soon?
Yeah, well, that's also interesting because it's not really clear when that's going to happen. So people are basically waiting on their, they're very stressed out at this point. The people in Lebanon are not knowing what to expect, and they have no idea when this demonstration will take place. So this demonstration is said to topple the government, although through peaceful means. But it's still quite an uncertain thing to face in your daily life. It's not really knowing when the government will be toppled. And this is not, you know, not new in Lebanon. We're used to a lot of surprises from the recent wars. So it's really an uncertain situation for everybody at this point. Hezbollah's rally was supposed to take place on the day after the assassination of the minister. So everyone was waiting for Hezbollah to make a move, and instead this event happened and really changed the whole focus of the international community at that time. But I think that that was a temporary measure, and now again we are waiting for Hezbollah's rally.
But all of the ministers in this government basically are holed up in their homes behind bodyguards. They're afraid to even go outside, so it's a pretty tense situation. And you mentioned that the country itself, the political formulas are based upon religious affiliations. But didn't you tell me earlier that there hasn't really been a census in the country, so nobody really knows whether these formulas are connected to the real demographic realities.
Yeah, that's true. And as I said, I mean, I think today's differences are more political than religious, so it doesn't really make sense that much in this context to divide things in that way. I mean, certain religious communities don't really always have the same opinion. We've had, during the Lebanese Civil War, almost every side has taken every side. So it's really not accurate to identify people by their religion when people from the same religion have different political views. But that's really the basis of the Lebanese political system, and it's a very weak basis, actually. So many Lebanese are very interested in changing the political system in the country. But then again, people, the current league of leaders is opposed to that, because that could jeopardize their power situation, and no one really knows what the population of Lebanon is. No one really knows what the population of Christians in Lebanon are, the population of Muslims. It's really a lot of speculation, a lot of various surveys, but every survey, as we know, can be manipulated in certain ways. So no one really knows that there's, you know, 4 million people in Lebanon, 4.5 million, 5 million, 6 million. It's very hard to match up the current demographics in the country with the political system, especially because it dates back to the 1930s.
Well, just in closing then, Habib, but it seems that I sort of detect a kind of, you know, sort of sad resignation in your voice, if I'm not reading too much into it, but give me your personal feelings about what you think is going to happen and whether anything can be done to thwart this kind of, you know, drift to war.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that, you know, even in times of peace, we still have this uncertainty in our lives. The hope is that people will, cooler heads will prevail, and that there will be a dialogue again between the country's leaders. I'm not sure that Lebanese, the only hope that I have is that Lebanese has suffered a lot during the past wars. And I don't believe the same dynamics are there that existed during the Civil War. Especially the procurement of arms among all the parties. Now the arms are mainly concentrated in one Lebanese political party, and really that's Hezbollah, and the decision really lies with them what's going to happen to this country at this point in time. The hope is that they will make a good decision and will be able to maintain stability in the country. It is kind of depressing, though, because, I mean, Lebanon was really set for a really strong economic performance in the past 3 or 4 years. Lebanon was really getting a lot of tourism popularity from all over the world. People were coming here and holding a lot of big international concerts, and development of the downtown area is huge. A lot of multi-billion-dollar projects going on. So it is sad to see things to be put on hold like this, but then again, you hope that, as I said, cooler heads will prevail, and we can return to that path of economic prosperity that we were on just a year and a half ago.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Habib Bitar.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So just speaking there with Habib Bitar, who's in Beirut, Lebanon. He's a print and broadcast journalist who works for Al Jazeera, Daily Star newspaper, and the Beirut-based satellite channel Future Television. Now we'll move to the subject of the apparent assassination of a former KGB officer who had been granted political asylum in Great Britain, and We'll be speaking in a moment with Milton Leitenberg, as a senior research scholar at the Center for International Strategic Studies in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. He is a biochemist specializing in neurochemistry and has been working in the field of international arms control since 1966. He's an acknowledged expert on the use of poison for political assassination. And joining us from Great Britain is Philip Knightley, who's an award-winning journalist, critic, and author specializing in intelligence services. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Lincoln, England, and has written a number of acclaimed books, including The First Casualty, The Second Oldest Profession, and Philby, the KGB Master Spy. And, of course, Philip Knightley was the only Western journalist to have met with the master spy, Kim Philby, in Moscow in 1988. Let me just begin with Philip Knightley in London. I imagine the town is abuzz, not the least of which is that they keep finding traces of this polonium-210 in sushi bars and hotels. And what about the people at the hospital that treated Litvinenko? Wouldn't they also be possibly exposed?
Yes. Yes, of course they would. And even more important, it's going to delay any post-mortem on the body because of the risk that the people performing the post-mortem would be put at risk as well. In fact, I spoke to one nuclear physicist today who said he thought that the only way that the post-mortem could be performed safely would be to put the body in refrigeration, which it probably already is at the moment, for a period until the radioactivity declines, and that could take anything from 1 to 2 years.
And let me ask Milton Leitenberg, since he's a specialist in these exotic poisons, and in this case the isotope polonium-210, give me a sense of what the hazards are of this contaminated body.
Well, I don't think it's that much, in fact. Polonium-210 is a isotope which is nearly a pure alpha ray emitter. Radioactive isotopes produce two types of radiation, usually gamma rays and alpha rays. Gamma rays are the very penetrating ones that require heavy lead shielding or graphite bricks. Alpha rays don't go through a sheet of paper or your shirt. I think the autopsy risk is in case they inhaled, if they got an aerosol of any of the bodily fluids. But I think that's highly unlikely, but that could be protected by masks. The half-life means how quickly a radioactive isotope reduces by half its strength. And polonium is relatively short. It's about 100 days. So in 100 days, we'd go down by half. In another 100 days, we'd go down by half again. So in 200 days, there would only be one quarter left. So you wouldn't have to keep it terribly long. But in any case, what it tells you is that this polonium that was introduced into the victim's body had to have been made relatively recently. And it also tells you that the operation was planned in advance.
And how do you transport this?
Very simply. It doesn't require, just as I described, it doesn't require any lead shielding or anything.
Right.
It could just go in a glass tube. I don't think they'd put it in an envelope because the amount they used is extremely small. And it's in milligram quantities, is enough to kill someone. And so they probably put it in a little glass tube. If it was sprayed on his food, it would be in some sort of little pen-like device, which actually had a spray device attached to it. In other words, something that's prepared, a very special device that's prepared for these kinds of uses, not something commercially available. And it can be carried safely. And it won't register in most radioactive detectors either. You have to have special kinds of detectors to register alpha rays.
I see.
So in other words, you would not be detected if you were carrying it.
Well, let me ask Philip Knightley in London then. What is the speculation there? Because you do have a number of former KGB spies there. They're kind of the dean, I guess, would be Oleg Gordievsky, who I believe has gone on television and accused the Kremlin, as of course the victim himself and his deathbed note that he left lays it squarely at Putin. But why? I imagine people are speculating if the KGB or the successor organization was behind this, why would they leave such an obvious evidence trail?
Well, the speculation is that it is the KGB. I speculated on those lines myself in something I wrote for a newspaper today, saying purely on the grounds of previous form, as the police say, the KGB must remain a major suspect, and also because only an organization like the KGB or a scientist attached to the KGB would have access to this material and the know-how on how to use it. So it remains the prime suspect. However, there is other speculation about who might be responsible, and even going as wild as to suggest that it's possible that Litvinenko might have committed suicide in this manner and had one last glorious swipe at the KGB, or the SVB as it's called now, FVB?
FSB.
Had so many names, the KGB.
Yeah.
That this would be was his last operation. And the reason that people think also it might be either rogue elements within the KGB or not very high up the chain of command is that this might have been intended as a message to other KGB people who might consider defecting themselves. It was the service itself punishing what they considered to be a disloyal traitor.
Can I come in on
yes,
that?
Yes, Milton, by all means.
Okay. I think Philip Knightley's last remark is very important. Many people have said, well, why would, if it was the government that was responsible, why would they pick something that was so easily identifiable? I think that's very obvious. I think it was meant to be identified. It's too difficult, in fact, to miss it. And I think they're simply sending a message. Either we'll do you in beforehand, or you'll pay with your life. And this is not, you know, the first case. And I think that's the most important part of this whole story. And that's the book that Litvinenko wrote in 2003, and it is his relation to the assassination just a month or two ago of Anna Politkovskaya. And her editor in 2003 was poisoned as well. And I think it's very significant what the official Russian government reaction to that was. They publicly stated, they didn't have to say anything, was that he died of an allergic reaction. I mean, that's like putting out a big, big notice board saying, we're sneering at you. It's obvious we do these kinds of things, and this is the stupid way we'll answer you.
So, in other words, this is Putin is a brazen thug. He doesn't care what the international opinion is because he's it's more important to him to send a message to the people at home, which is that we're in charge and nobody had better try and screw with us. And more importantly, the message he's sending to the his FSB.
No, not to the FSB. It's to people who write. The crucial thing is not simply that this man was an FSB defector. The crucial thing is the subject of the book he wrote in 2003.
Which posits that Putin was behind the killing of all the hundreds of Russians that were blown up in the apartment buildings.
That's
it was
right.
Blamed on the Chechens, and it became the pretext for the Second War.
And again,
it also propelled Putin to power as well.
That's right. It's the last of those two things that matter. It's not only the unfortunate 300 people. The point is that this was the pretext. Putin was prime minister. Putin had been made just a year before the head of the FSB. Then he was quickly appointed prime minister by Yeltsin after three successive other people were replaced quickly. Kasyanov and Stepashin, I can't remember the third one. And he came in August 1999. The bombings were in September 1999. He then quickly formed these political parties and went on to win the presidency as a strong person for having put down these terrorists, ostensibly put down in Chechnya. And that's crucial. That book is titled The FSB Blows Up Russia. I mean, this would be the whole raison d'etre of Putin's ascendancy to power. Now, of course, it wouldn't turn him out of office at this point, but it would be the most serious, black mark that could be on any administration. So this is not an ordinary dissident or an ordinary defector from the KGB.
And Philip Knightley, given the charges in the book and the residual suspicion that the book is actually accurate, and it's worth noting that all of the efforts on the part of the Duma, the parliament, to investigate the bombing of these apartment buildings, I think the first two heads of the inquiries, the parliamentary inquiries, were both former KGB men. They were both assassinated. I believe a third one was put in jail. So it's pretty obvious that the powers that be don't want anybody to look into this.
Well, I would think that's true, yes. I mean, the idea of false flag and the greater good being served by things like blowing up your own people is not entirely new. We've just reread Graham Greene's The Quiet American, or look at, let's go back a bit further, look at the way that the Second World War started with an attack on German frontier posts by Polish troops, which weren't Polish troops at all, but Germans wearing Polish uniforms. And the justification for authoritarian powers for doing this is that it's for the greater good of the country at the time. The one thing I think that might enable whoever did this to get away with it is the anxiety on the part at the moment, anyway, of the British government to remain good friends with Russia because of trade deals and the fact that most of Western Europe's gas suppliers come from the Soviet Union, and we don't want to upset things.
Well, that's a pretty sad state of affairs in terms of how Putin got to this position. I mean, it seems to me that what happened there was during the Yeltsin period, that the KGB, after all, the KGB were the only people that really knew what was happening in Russia before the fall, and they are the ones that had formed a compact with the organized crime in order to keep the economy going. So they, in effect, were regulating organized crime. So after the collapse, they were the only people in a position to be the sort of nexus between crime and neo-capitalism. But it seems like they played a good hand. They stayed laid low, let the billionaires confiscate all the state assets and form these vast fortunes, and then they seem to be. It seems as though Putin has picked off the billionaires one by one, starting with the media guys Berezovsky and Kaczynski, and then driving some of them to exile, putting some in jail, and essentially taking over the whole place. So let me ask you, Milton: do you think that this has been a kind of KGB operation all along? That it's in fact Russia is now KGB incorporated?
I was going to put that a little different way, but yes. The answer is yes, in a slightly more diplomatic way. With Putin's becoming president, there's this Russian phrase, the Siloviki, where he began to put former KGB generals in major administrative posts in the government. First, he made most of them regional governors, replacing the regional governors. But much more important, they went into the Kremlin administration. So you have a large number. I guess someone could present you with a list of them. There are a dozen of these figures that have major administrative responsibility in the Kremlin. And these are all former KGB / FSB people. Another thing which I think is useful in relation to the murder in particular is that Putin quite recently had the Duma, it was his inspired legislation, this piece of legislation which authorized the FSB to, quote, take action against terrorists outside the country. Now, whether the KGB defector is defined as a terrorist or not in their terms, I don't know. But certainly anything having to do with the Chechen War is defined as terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Anna Politkovskaya.
Right.
And Litvinenko's last efforts were apparently to try and disclose the responsible parties for her murder.
Well, I'm afraid, gentlemen, we've run out of time. Obviously, something is at least on our side, on the Western side. We clearly haven't been, watching the ball here. And I guess the extent to which we've been sidetracked in Iraq has allowed Putin a free rein. Bush looked into his eyes and saw his soul, but he's certainly, we're talking about the soul of a secret policeman, if that's not an oxymoron. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but I thank you, Philip Knightley in London and Milton Leitenberg of the University of Maryland.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Hello again, Amy and Masters. This program has been Background Briefing. I thank the producer, Lewis Vandenberg, the assistant producer, Rusty Wynn, and assistant producer, Carol Coote, Melissa Figueroa, our engineer.